15. A few days later, the tree ship reached the barony of Lochinville. Loch stood by Ululenia at the railing as her family's land flew by far below them. There was the river that marked the border of the barony, cutting through the forest where Ululenia had periodically appeared to do business with her father. From this high, the trees looked like a rough green carpet, and the river was a silver wire catching the late afternoon light. "I thought we had another day," she said, still not used to how fast the tree ships move. "The elves would be a formidable force if they wished," Ululenia said, holding the railing with both hands as though drawing strength from it. "Their druids have magic far stronger than mine." Locke looked down at the tiny bridge where she had once practiced diving into the river. "Always thought you had the nature magic because you were something like a nature spirit." Ululenia smiled. "We are as the chameleon in the grass, little one. The ancient device that failed and weakened was in the middle of a forest, and so I came into being there, and saw what was around me, and thought in my innocence that it was what I should be." She put a hand on Locke's shoulder. "You, I believe, are the reverse."
"Maybe."
Locke looked at the long grassy field where she had learned to ride. The farmers had taken a few more acres for crops. Her father wouldn't have allowed that. The estate itself came into view as the tree ship came over a final hill that was really a small mountain, tall enough that the tree ship had to divert course to go around it. Lochinville was a great castle, once ringed by an old moat, that Locke's father had drained and filled in, leaving only different coloured stone to mark where water had once been. Around the castle a town had sprung up, called Lochinville as well, for simplicity. Locke looked down at the sturdy townhouses and simple shops, thickest around the road that led to the main gates. When Locke had fled to join the army, the buildings had ended in a huge open-air market that served as a fairground when travelling performers came to play. The circular market was still there, but it was ringed entirely by buildings now, and stones had been laid down over the dirt, she remembered. She remembered digging rocks out from where she'd scraped her knees falling on that dirt, and wondered where the kids played these days. "It has grown," Ululenia observed.
"Things do that."
"You have not been back since you left to join the war?"
"No." She remembered the cold pre-dawn air and the unfamiliar weight of the pack on her back. It was filled with several days' worth of food, pen and paper, all the money she had saved, and a letter from Savert that she was supposed to deliver to the recruiter. It had seemed so heavy, the straps tight around her arms as she quietly made her way to the stables for the ride her father had ordered her not to make. "No, I was stationed too far away to visit on leave, and then Silliston framed me, and he owned the land."
"You still would have had friends," Ululenia pointed out.
"Friends who would have gotten in trouble for helping me." Locke grinned and looked over at her. "As we've seen."
"And because you left to prove yourself," Ululenia added. "You could hardly return home with an enemy who had beaten you."
"Were you always this shrewd?" Locke asked. "Or is this a new part of you being evil?" Ululenia smiled back and put a finger to the railing again, and a tiny flower sprouted and bloomed under her touch.
"How will you approach your sister, little one?"
In a way, Locke was glad someone had finally asked. "I will appeal to our sisterhood and hope that she will help." Ululenia blinked.
"I see."
"It's either that or open with,
'Hi, remember how you tried to kill me while working for the guy who killed our parents, but then I took you down and had the chance to kill you, and I didn't take it?'"
Locke consciously stood straighter, aware that she'd begun to tense up. "I don't know what I'm going to say. I have to play it by how she reacts." And she thought they'd had another day, or at least had been telling herself that. An airship landing field was set up outside the town. It was empty, and the tree ship settled down smoothly into the field, coming to rest with a nearly imperceptible little bump. Locke met Captain Thelenia at the gangplank. "Captain."
"Captain,"
Thelenia smiled.
"Would it help you if I had us remain here until you were certain that you had another means of transportation?"
"I would appreciate that greatly." Locke offered her hand, and Thelenia took it. "I will send someone back to report our progress, one way or another. If I don't see you again, thank you."
"May you hunt well," Thelenia said in reply.
and Locke nodded and headed into town.
If I am not needed, Ulilenia said, I will visit the forest.
She walked off, a pale woman in a pale dress, and shimmered into her natural form at the edge of the woods. The others followed behind Locke. She knew they were there, but kept her eyes on the town as she walked in and then through. The roads were indeed paved now, and in good shape. A wagon rolled in from the main highway, and Locke heard the horses' hooves clopping on good-quality stones. The townsfolk, many Orajar, but some white as well, nodded as she approached. Lochinville was big enough to have merchants' wagons ringing the market, but small enough for the people to notice them coming. An old Orajar man was playing a jaunty tune on a six-stringed vihuela on the main stage of the market square, while a puppeteer's wagon set up the stage behind him. He had played in the pre-dinner hours ever since Locke could remember, his old fingers plucking and strumming songs that the townsfolk likely did not even consciously hear anymore.
"I have some ideas for how to deal with the ambient magic at Sunrise Canyon, now that I've seen it," Hessler said. "I'll need to pick up a few things."
Locke nodded, and he went off toward the stalls with Derry in tow.
"You're going to be okay?" Tern asked.
Locke smiled. "I'll be fine."
"You've saved the Republic twice," she said, with a little more intensity than was really called for. "And you have nothing to be ashamed of."
"Thanks," Locke said. "I agree. And we're hugging." "We're hugging." She patted Tern on the back. "Thanks, Tern."
"All right, I've got stuff to get to," Tern said, and disentangled herself from Locke.
She walked off toward where Hessler was at the market stalls.
"She means well," Icy said,
and Locke nodded and smiled as he followed Tern. Locke reached the estate's gates soon after. The late afternoon shadows stretched from the town buildings almost to the walls, making it seem quieter than it really was. The gates were open, and the guards chatted with townsfolk who walked by. They stopped as she approached, and one of them, a young white woman, called,
"Good afternoon. You have business inside?"
As Locke opened her mouth to respond, the other guard, an Orajar woman whose tight curls had gone completely white and whose face was lined with both wrinkles and scars, cut in.
"Issefa Sera? Aita, is that you? They said some crazy military man had killed you at a peace conference with the Empire."
"They say a lot of things, Yashki." Locke turned to Kale and Desidora. "Tala, this is Kale, who served with me in the war, and Desidora, who's working with us now. Kale and Desidora, this is Tala. She taught me how to use a sword."
"A few lessons when your father wasn't looking," Tala said, grinning. "Since his little girl was going to cut her own foot off on the downswing if someone didn't help her."
It had been more than a few lessons, and Locke clasped hands with her gladly.
"Look at you, all grown up. Your mother and father would be so proud."
"How is Naria?" Locke asked, and Tala's smile softened around the edges.
"Your parents would be proud of her too," she said. "Lochinville has done well under her."
Tala gestured for Locke to come inside.
"She is busy with some nobles who arrived today. Perhaps if you waited in the water garden."
"The reports all said she was dead," the young guard said. "We should at least use an illusion ward charm to—"
She withered under Tala's steady stare. "Yashki, I don't mind," said Locke. Tala sighed, and her hand went to the hilt of the blade at her hip.
"Strike!"
Her blade hissed from its sheath with a crosscut that would have taken Locke across the gut had she not gotten her walking stick up. Moving to the side, Tala stabbed low, then high, stepping in as Locke parried. She stomped at Locke's foot, then shouldered in as Locke lifted her foot to avoid the stomp. Locke had ended up on the ground countless times as Tala had taught her that dirty little trick. This time she stepped aside, letting Tala move past her, and tapped the older woman on the back with her walking stick. "Dead," she said, as the wooden stick plinked off Tala's armor.
"Dead,"
Tala snorted as she sheathed her blade, ignoring the young guard's confused protestations.
"Not with this armor, Aita. I taught you to go for the head."
"My father taught me to respect my elders, Yeshki," Locke shot back. "Besides, if I knocked you senseless, nobody would be awake to remember me." She brought her stick back to the ground, leaning on it casually, and turned to the young guard. "If you would like to use your illusion ward charm, I have no objections."
That won't be necessary, the guard said, and waved Locke, Kale and Isadora in.
Tala walked alongside them as they came into the small but nicely maintained Lockenville estate. Some of the sculptures on the front lawn could have sat in any noble's garden, comprised of bronze goddesses and old heroes. Other figures had been commissioned in bronze and marble, but were done in the old Urujar style, simplified forms with long, smooth limbs and gentle curves. As a girl, Locke had argued with her mother about them. The old statues had been made from wood or clay, and Locke had said it was disrespectful to use the materials of the people who had enslaved the Urujar to make Urujar art. She remembered her mother's wry smile and sighed.
"You all right, Captain?" Kale asked.
"Just thinking back to when I was young and stupid, Kale." Desidora smiled at Locke with eyes that looked older than her years. Not in a death priestess way, but in a way that all good priests eventually learn to cultivate.
"Tern sees you and her as similar, escaping your home and having to come back. But she didn't want to leave, did you?"
"I wanted to serve my country," Locke said.
Tala laughed. "You wanted adventure, Aita."
"And that?" Locke grinned at her, then turned back to Desidora. "But had Silliston not framed me, killed my family, stolen the land, I would have come back."
"You're back now," Tala said,
and Isadora nodded. Locke was back. She would wait in the garden as a guest. The water garden was a great pool of waist-deep water, where brightly coloured fish swam in slow, peaceful circles. Water lilies covered much of its surface, their white and purple petals glowing in the slanting light of the late afternoon, and little wooden bridges arched between marble platforms set with benches and chairs for quiet reflection. Columns shaped like tumbled stone rose from each platform to block the sight lines. Some piped water out in artful streams or bubbling cascades, and all were reeds and flowering vines, as were the ropes that connected the columns to create a gentle bower that kept the worst of the hot summer sun off the garden. Tala led them across several little bridges and stopped at one platform with a long bench and a small chair.
"If you will wait here, Isafasira, I will tell Naria you are here. It will not be long."
"Thank you." Locke nodded, and Tala made her way across the bridges to the white steps that led inside the manor.
"Your home is lovely," Desidora said, settling down on one of the benches. Kale sat beside her.
Locke sat as well. It was a good place to grow up. The falling water had left the air misty, a pleasant change in the hot weather, and she closed her eyes for a moment to let the cool breeze kiss her face.
"Yeah, my water garden was a mud hole at the edge of town," Kale said,
and then started as a great splash sounded behind him. Locke smiled and pointed, without opening her eyes, at a long wooden tube that was dumping a huge sheet of water down behind them.
"Water clock," she said. "It's set at an angle, and when it gets full enough, precisely at every half hour, it will tip over and pour the water out."
"Kind of stupid garden, this sudden noises," Kale muttered, settling back down.
"You are all right?" Desidora asked Locke.
Locke nodded, forced a smile.
"It'll be a better reunion than the last time I saw her. Ideally, we won't be trying to kill each other."
"That why your knuckles are white on your stick, Captain?" Kale asked.
Locke put the walking stick down in the unoccupied chair.
"Thank you, Kale."
They waited in silence for a time. The water clock emptied again, prompting Kale to swear. Locke stood up, eyes shut, smelling the flowers on the vines, remembering. Finally, she opened her eyes at the sound of booted feet coming down the stairs. Tala waved for her to come in, and Locke turned to Kale and Desidora.
"I shouldn't be long."
"Good luck, Captain."
Kale tossed her a lazy salute. Locke left her walking stick in the chair and crossed the bridges to get to the stairs. She met Tala's smile with her own as they walked up and into the manor. Naria had left the interior furnishings the same as when Locke's parents had been alive. Classic paintings and tapestries sat in the hallways, and sitting rooms were furnished with Urujar rope art and statues. These in the authentic clay and wood that young Isafasira de Lockenville had approved of. While the rooms were richly carpeted, the hallway floors were bare. It had been a compromise between her mother, who loved to dig her toes into the soft rugs, and her father, who liked the sound of his heels clicking on the stone.
Tala brought Locke not to a sitting room but to the receiving hall, where guests first met the family. White marble tiles were inlaid with malachite that twined vine-like across their surface, and a golden pattern scrawled across the entirety of the floor, drawing the eye to the raised dais where a single throne sat, lined with velvet and decorated with crystals at the arms and back. Naria de Lockenville looked down at Locke from the throne. A pretty young woman in a dusky orange gown that brought out the golden tones of her own skin. Her eyes were covered with crystal lenses, a legacy from the same attack that had killed Locke's parents. The last time she and Locke had met, Locke had crushed the lenses under the heel of her boot after Naria's failed attempt to kill her. Locke supposed Naria had picked up new ones. Locke walked in silence to where the gold scrollwork pattern on the floor ended, just before the steps to the dais. Guards stood on either side of the steps, holding great ornamental halberds and with far more practical blades at their hips. Locke looked up at Naria, who had said nothing. "Baroness de Lockenville," Locke said, and bowed low. She rose from her bow to the sound of light laughter. "Oh, Issa," said her sister, smiling brightly from the throne. "You have no idea how long I have waited to hear you say that.